afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Tuesday, the 10th of July of the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll be talking to Suzanne Williams about the upcoming Southeast Master Gardeners Annual Garden Tour. We'll meet members of the Resurrection Lutheran Quilters, and John Gagin and Rory Darling will be here to talk about Lane Bridge. That writer's almanac, Bird Note Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers, low temperatures around 48 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers and high temperatures around 60 degrees. Wednesday night, mostly cloudy with isolated showers. And Thursday, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain, high temperatures around 62 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Monday, we began the first of a two-part series on how the Susquehanna Western Uranium Mill started on the Wind River Reservation. In the first part, we heard from Mark Soldier Wolf, an Arapaho elder who claims the mill robbed him of his land, and Lynn Jenkins, a former Bureau of Indian Affairs official who claimed Soldier Wolf was involved with the sale of that land. Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone brings you the second part of a nearly year-long investigation.
Through the Freedom of Information Act, we learned that all of Mark Soldier Wolf's family signed consents of sale, including minors. However, the BIA provided no indication that money was ever paid for the land, and Mark Soldier Wolf claims his family was never reimbursed. On top of that, Deborah Donahue, a professor of Indian law at the University of Wyoming, says the paperwork raises ethical and moral questions.
They did not have full information because even the BIA didn't have full information, for instance, about the potential for water pollution.
Why is this? Because both the BIA and landowners never got a U.S. Geological Survey report about the potential for water pollution promised by then-acting Wind River Superintendent Arthur Arntzen. So the BIA did not have the very documents and evidence that they needed to justify the purchase and building of Susquehanna Western, but moved ahead anyway. It's unclear if that report ever showed up or was even authored, since it wasn't included in the documents the BIA provided.
And yet, at the same time, Superintendent Arntzen said, "We feel this conveyance will be in the best interest of the Indian landowners and the Indian people as a whole in the community and on the reservation." What's happened since then puts that in a different light.
Freedom of Information Act requests have been submitted for the missing USGS report on water pollution from 1957 to help make sense of the current problems the Wind River Reservation faces with uranium contamination. In the meantime, Mark Soldier Wolf has offered to provide all information on trust accounts for himself and his family, and has asked the BIA to provide evidence of payment for his land, leaving the burden on the federal government to prove he was compensated. The complete report is available online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
A recent economic analysis shows one Oklahoma tribe is contributing billions of dollars to the state's economy. As KGOU's Kirk Wartney reports, the Chickasaw Nation is also diversifying its economic base.
16,000 jobs and $2.4 billion. Those are the top-line numbers the Chickasaw Nation contributes to the Oklahoma economy each year. The study by an economist at Oklahoma City University shows the tribe still depends on gambling for most of its revenue, but other areas are growing. The Chickasaw Nation operates a bank in Oklahoma City, owns investments in a medical device company, and also runs a chocolate factory. State officials say the tribe and its businesses are one of Oklahoma's largest employers. Chickasaw Nation Governor Bill Anitubby says the tribe's economic activities are woven into the economic fabric of the state. He says the fiscal success of the tribe allows for investments that benefit both the Chickasaw people and residents of Oklahoma. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and U.S. attorneys for South Dakota and North Dakota are signing a Memorandum of Understanding. The agreement between the tribe and the U.S. Justice Department authorizes the hiring of a special assistant U.S. attorney to prosecute violence against women cases in tribal and federal courts. The prosecutor will handle cases on the Standing Rock Reservation situated in both states. A signing ceremony is taking place today in Fort Yates, North Dakota. On this day in 1836, a Creek band was captured. About 900 Creek people were forced to march from Alabama to Oklahoma. Their traditional homeland was in the southeastern United States. In 1836 and 37, more than 20,000 Creeks were removed to Indian territory. Some remained in the southeast. The Oklahoma tribe today is the Muscogee Creek Nation. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for National Native News comes from the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller, and Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a June afternoon. Our first guest is here to remind us to mark your calendars for July 14th and 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. for the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners Annual Garden Tour. Suzanne Williams, thank you for coming down to the station today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me. But we want everybody to come, rain or shine, put on those raincoats, put on your hat, maybe stick a small notebook in your pocket and a pencil, and go look around and see what people are doing in spite of our terrible summer.
But it's a summer anyway. It's better than no summer at all.
Oh, you said that right. The cost of the tickets is $20, and they're good for one or both days, and there's no discount. It's flat rate for everybody from no children under 10, though, and no cats or dogs. And it's good for 2 days. We've got 15 gardens to tour this season. There are 6 gardens in the Valley area and 9 on Douglas Island on Sunday. Saturday is the Valley. Sunday is Douglas Island. The big thing is it's a self-guided tour. You buy your ticket. You can buy them at the Jack at www.jahc.org or Gaharside Books or on the Southeast Alaska Master Web Guard, Master Gardeners website, which is lowercase calaskamastergardeners.org. And you can buy them in advance. But once you have your ticket, on Saturday the 14th, not on Sunday, just Saturday, you can go to the Juneau A&P supermarket in downtown Juneau or out at Kay's Car Softway Food Court store between 11:30 and 1 o'clock, and you give your ticket and you get a wristband, a map guide, and a garden description of all the gardens. You can go in any order. You also, if you didn't get your ticket in advance, you can pick up a ticket at those two locations. So off with your map and your wristband. You go around to take a look and see what people are doing in the Juneau area. Mind you that many of these gardens are on hillside because we are living in a very mountainous area here in Southeast Alaska. So some of the guides will tell you which have narrow paths or stairs involved for those of you that might be concerned about steps. Some of the gardeners have interesting features like waterfalls. Some have raised beds, which are really helpful in this wet, rainy climate. Some have been doing interesting rock walls. Some are more into flowers, some into vegetables, not as many into vegetables. But it's interesting to see what combinations are. Some of the gardens are hidden. And so you have to go round and back, or maybe you have to go through a gate or an arbor or drive further into the area and take a look at these secret places. So it's a wonderful experience. Some have been gardening for a long time. Some are new gardeners. Some want to know your advice. So I think it's a wonderful experience. You get to visit with gardeners. You get to talk about it and what people are doing in this wet climate of ours.
Before I get too much further, could you tell me a little bit about the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners, please?
The Southeast Master Gardeners are part of the University of Fairbanks Extension Service, and they teach gardeners a gardening class, usually starting in January, and it's a 14-hour course that gives us extensive experience and lessons on what types of soils, vegetables, and plants that grow well, how to prune, what trees and shrubs do well, what to do with diseases and pests. And after we put in our 40 hours in the class, we also give 40 hours of volunteer labor to the Extension Service, which is used in the northern part of Southeast Alaska. I, for example, do schedule programming for the Johnson Youth Center. I have a team of gardeners that go out every Friday for an hour and a half, and we garden with the boys at the Johnson Youth Center, which has a huge garden, two greenhouses, and they mainly grow vegetables out there. Plus, we teach a basic gardening class during winter months, but we do garden with the boys out there. Also, the money from this project right here, the garden tours, goes to a scholarship fund. And for the past 20 years, we've been giving out scholarships for students going into the field of horticulture, botany, landscaping, environment, agriculture, and related areas for graduating seniors. And we give out two scholarships per year so far. If we have more money, we give out more. We also give out prize money for the Juneau School District's annual science fairs, which are held every year. And also we help with the judging. We've also done some projects. We don't do maintenance work. We do startup projects, like we have given money to start the Juneau Community Garden years ago. We've also given money to do the plants, do the shrubs and trees out at the Wildflower Court near the hospital. And we do, every other year or so, we put on a garden conference. This year was a mini garden conference up in the Haines area. So usually we're a teacher. We'll help schools set up their garden, or if they want to do a science project, we help teach. And if people have questions online on our site, you can send in a question and ask, and we'll get a master gardener back to you to give you an answer.
Talking with Suzanne Williams about the Southeast Alaska Master Gardeners Annual Garden Tour, which is scheduled for July 14th and 15th. How do you pick your gardens?
It's done by the Master Gardeners. Basically, we go out and ask. Well, if we're driving around, we'll ask friends, do you know of a garden we haven't seen? Would somebody be willing to volunteer? Not everybody wants someone tramping around their property. So if there's a privacy issue. So if they're willing and they feel like, oh, all right, we'll get it whipped in shape. So they let us come on, and we're just thankful for all these people in the area. I have two examples, one in Douglas. One is Rosemary Hagevig, who's been gardening for years in the borough and been a longtime member of the Juneau Garden Club. She's graciously allowed us to come and look at her garden again. And the other one is Clay McDole, who also lives in Douglas. And he has a fabulous garden with a creek running through it, and he's been gardening for a long time. And one in the valley that's well-known, I think, to everybody is Pearson's Palm, which is absolutely incredible. It has a pond, and it has little secluded areas, and it's very romantic. And I think people enjoy looking at that. We don't have the same every year. We try to pick a variety. We like some with a sense of humor. We like some that are doing something new that we've never thought of before. Someone who's maybe has a whole stream running through their yard and had been able to, get it under control and turn it into a natural and not flooding everybody out. One year we had somebody who had a swampy backyard, and the couple with their teenage boys dug out the swamp, managed to put in gravel so it drains well. It was a two-year undertaking, and turned this into a beautiful area that doesn't flood anymore. There are people out there doing amazing things.
Over the years, has there emerged a typical garden?
Not really. I think one thing stands out is we are in a rainforest, and many of us are living on hillsides, so it's rare to find a flat piece of property. I would say that's one thing that stands out.
What's more popular, food or ornamentals? And if food, as you said so earlier, what kind of food?
Well, not as many grow food. My husband and I do grow food. We grow peas. I grow my oregano this year is fantastic. I grow garlic. I grow onions. In our greenhouse, we have tomatoes and cucumbers. And I grow some basil, but I grow a lot of lettuce, kale, chard, high in vitamin C and iron. And I grow at least five or six different types of lettuce, radishes. I have thyme, I have sage, I have chives and hedges. And I grow carrots and beets, but this year it's a sad year for carrots and beets, and I'm not alone on that one. I think it was just too cold, but I'm trying.
In this year of record rainfall, is there any advice you have for people to take care of their gardens, especially with the rain?
Don't give up. Put on your rain gear, put on your boots, get your hat on, and go out and try. Maybe some things won't grow this year, but other things do. So it's always different every year. It's like going to Las Vegas, gambling. Sometimes you win and sometimes you don't.
You talked about raised beds in this kind of weather.
Yes. Southeast Alaska, you're better off if you can raise up the dirt. In other words, you can make a mound, dig it up, make a mound. You can shore it up with logs or stones, or you can buy untreated lumber. Not treated, because you don't want the chemicals to get into your soil. Untreated lumber that's at least 2 inches thick, and that takes about 10 to 15 years before it breaks down. And also adding peat moss and some sand to our Alaskan soil. And I like to use perlite, and you stir that all in along with your fertilizer. And that's because you're trying to get it drained. A raised bed, the soil is warmer, and also it drains quicker. But unfortunately, the nutrients also wash out. So we also side dress during the middle of the summer, and this year we're doing it once a month. We're side dressing with Alaska fertilizer. If you go to the hardware store, the bag says on it 18-32-16, and that's the type of fertilizer that you want to side dress, put a sprinkle around every month around your vegetables and plants, so it doesn't wash out as fast.
Now, I'm assuming the side dressing is nothing at all like cross-dressing.
No, it's not. It is sprinkling a little on and stirring it up with a little rake.
Suzanne Williams talking about the annual garden tour for the Southeast Master Gardeners. And tell me again how to get tickets and when they'll be available.
Their tickets are online, are available at Hearthside Books, or you can go to the Jack, or you can buy them online at the Jack, which is jahc.org, or the Southeast Alaska Master Gardener.org website. And they're $20 for both days, and it's a bargain because you're going to get 15 gardens and a wonderful afternoon. And we try to get as many as you can drive around comfortably between 1 and 4 o'clock. And with the list, you can go in any order you want.
All right, Suzanne, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Oh, there will be a sign on each property that says garden tour here. So look for the sign. That will help you, too. To know that this is the property that you want to go take a peek at.
All right, Suzanne, thank you for coming down today.
You're welcome. Anytime.
Get your gloves and pull your work boots on. Gotta clear that patch, pick them stones. You know the sun is gonna warm those lazy bones. Winter's over and the work's just starting. Time to get busy in the family garden. Turning the soil and planting the seeds. Laying down mulch and pulling up weeds. Mowing the corn, row on row. Then you stand right back and you watch it grow. No, even little children gotta do their part and help it grow. Thank you.
got a cool spring rain and a summer breeze. Yellow squash, black-eyed peas, Japanese kale and pinto beans, Italian tomatoes and turnip greens. Now we're picking and a canning and a working hard and trying to beat the winter to the family. Got beans in the jar, potatoes in the bin. Got squash in the cellar, winter in the wind. Even the youngest gardener knows you're gonna reap just what you sow. Now we all say grace and then I beg your pardon. Won't you pass the pickles from the family garden? Berries on the bush, apples in the tree, growing in the garden like you have.
The Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 10th of July, 2012. It was 50 years ago today, 1962, the world's first commercial communications satellite was launched, Telstar 1, about 3 feet in diameter with an array of square solar panels over the surface. It's the birthday of Marcel Proust, born in Auteuil, France, in 1871. His major work, the 7-volume Remembrance of Things Past, known now as In Search of Lost Time. Proust's own life story, with the famous scene early on in the book when the narrator dips a bit of a madeleine, little cake, in some tea, and it carries the memory of his childhood. Proust wrote, "No sooner had the warm liquid mixed with the crumbs touched my palate than a shudder ran through me and I stopped, intent upon the extraordinary thing that was happening to me. An exquisite pleasure had invaded my senses, something isolated, detached, with no suggestion of its origin. It had on me the effect which love has of filling me with a precious essence. I had ceased now to feel mediocre, contingent, mortal. Whence could it have come to me, this all-powerful joy? And suddenly the memory revealed itself. The taste was that of the little piece of Madeleine, which on Sunday mornings at Cambrai, when I went to say good morning to her in her bedroom, my Aunt Leonie used to give me, dipping it first in her own cup of tea. The sight of the little Madeleine had recalled nothing to my mind before I tasted it, and all from my cup of tea. Which all really happened to Proust, although in his case it was a humbler food than a Madeleine. It was a piece of rusk, toast. He began the novel in June 1909, produced the first volume, Swan's Way, in 1913, spent the next decade working on the rest, and he was proofreading the final three unfinished volumes on his deathbed in 1922. It's the birthday of John Calvin, born in Picardy, France, 1509, who experienced a religious epiphany sometime in his early 20s. He embraced Protestantism when that was a dangerous thing to do in France, and he took to the road through France and Italy and Switzerland, finally settling in Geneva. And in 1536, he published his Institutes of the Christian Religion, laying out the foundations that we've come to know as Calvinism. Total depravity, all people born sinful, unconditional election, that God has chosen those people who will be saved, limited atonement, irresistible grace, if you are among the elect, you will inevitably repent and become a Christian, and perseverance of the saints, you can never lose your salvation. The five principles which spell out the word tulip. Here's a poem for today by Tennessee Williams, Covenant. If you are happy, I will give you an apple. If you are anxious, I will twist your arm. And if you permit me, I will be glad to hold you close to my heart forever and do you no harm. If I am happy, will you give me an apple? If I am anxious, you may twist my arm. And if you would like to, I would like you to hold me close to your heart forever and do me no harm. This is a bargain. Only two can make it. This is a covenant offered with desperate calm, it being uncertain that lovers can drive out demons with the gift of an apple or the twist of an arm. Covenant, a poem by Tennessee Williams from the collected poems of Tennessee Williams, published by New Directions, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, offering online review, monitoring, and management services for businesses that know the importance of online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. Produced by Nick Vetter, written by Holly Vanderhaar. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Boogie like there's no tomorrow at this year's Southeast Alaska State Fair, with incredible headliners like reggae artist Clinton Farron and the Boogie Brown Band. Move your feet to Bluegrass Americana with Larry and his Flash. Rockin' Saturday night is six-string guitar virtuoso Eric McFadden. Before you get your groove on, you will be mesmerized as circus art becomes high art with pendulum aerial art. Just a taste of what to expect at this year's Southeast Alaska State Fair, July 26th through the 29th. For a full lineup of entertainment, visit feakfair.org.
Time is 3:29, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guest is the Resurrection Lutheran Quilters. They're not all Lutherans, and they don't really make quilts, but they're here in the studio anyway. Loretta Mosley and Julie Nyhart, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you.
So your Wednesday group, Making Comforters, Not Quilts. Could you describe what you do, please?
Yes, I think we can do that. The reason we call them comforters and not quilts is because they are tied rather than quilted, which would mean that they would be stitched together more than what we do. And we start out by spreading a bottom, what we call a bottom, on a table or a set of tables. And then we put a filler, which is usually some batting on top of that. And then we put a top on it, and that may be just a single piece of fabric, or it may be a pieced fabric. And then we will pin those in place to show our tires where to tie. And then we will walk around and pin the hems in. And Loretta can tell you what happens next.
Then it goes to another group of ladies that tie the quilt. So if you know how to tie a knot or a square knot, we can show you what to do. After the quilts are tied, they're taken to another table where other ladies sew the hems around the edge, and our quilt is completed.
Any particular kind of fabric that you use?
Mostly cotton sheeting, bed sheets, that type of thing. We do use quilter cotton. We try to stay away from polyester.
And you meet at Resurrection Lutheran Church?
Every Wednesday, unless it's Christmas or...
Fourth of July.
About how long does it take to make a quilt or to make a comforter?
We're both baffled by that question, partly because we sort of do it assembly line, so it's difficult for us to determine how long each piece is from beginning to end. But what's your guess, Loretta?
Oh, gosh. I would guess 45 minutes to an hour.
How many comforters do you get done in a typical evening?
Probably 9. Is that a generous one? Too many?
5 to 9, yeah.
Maybe 5.
For a week, in a week, yes.
And what happens to the comforters when you're finished making them?
Well, we had originally started making these for Lutheran World Relief, and that's still where most of them go. And in addition, though, we do make some that stay in the community. So now we have agreements with AWARE so that when they need new covers for beds, they let us know when we make comforters for them. We did 40 for them around Christmas time this year.
It's a glory hole.
Did I say AWARE?
Yes.
I'm sorry. My apologies. You're right. It is the glory hole. And the other group that we make them for is one of the sororities in town, PEO Chapter G, because at Christmas time they adopt families for Christmas gifts, and if they have a family that would benefit from a comforter that we make, then we will give one to them.
About how many people are involved in your Wednesday night gatherings?
That also varies. People do travel a lot, so anywhere from 6 to 12 show up on a Wednesday.
And we start in the morning, so we advertise that we're there from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m., but we're actually there by about 8:30 in the morning and stay till 4 or 5 in the afternoon. But some people come for an hour, and some stay for that whole period of time.
Are you always looking for new people to join you?
We definitely are.
Absolutely.
And as Loretta mentioned, anybody can do this. In fact, I was thinking about it as I was thinking about coming here today, and I thought, you know, I think that someone who does not see well, who's actually blind, could do some part of our quilting. And I wondered about someone who couldn't hear, if they were deaf, how we do. We don't really have any fluent signers in our group, but I'm sure that we could communicate well enough to have someone who couldn't hear join our group. And we have wheelchair access, so someone in a wheelchair would certainly be welcome.
How many weeks have you been doing this?
We have been doing this since 1991.
Any idea how many comforters you've made?
Well, we know that approximately 3,940 have gone to Lutheran World Relief over that period of time, but I'm not sure how many total ones that we have made.
That is a lot of comfort.
Yes, indeed, and we hope it is a comfort to the people who receive them.
How much would you imagine it cost the materials to make each one? Another stumpy question.
We have to order our batting from Minnesota, so that's quite an expense. So we do a fundraiser once a year about to help pay for the batting.
When is your next fundraiser?
I think we'll have one this fall.
Okay, we'll
it's generally sort of an in-house type of thing. We have it at our church. We make up some special quilts and let people bid on those. And That's how we collect our money.
If people are interested, how could they get a hold of you or just come to the meetings at 10 o'clock on Wednesdays?
Absolutely. Or they could even call the church at 586-2380. But Wednesday, just about any time, if they'd like to show up and ask questions or help out, it would be wonderful.
All right, Loretta Mosley and Julie Nyhard, anything you'd like to add that I might have forgotten to ask?
I would like to add that we have a lot of donated materials, which make our comforters much less expensive than they would be if we had to buy everything.
Yes.
So we're very fortunate in that the community donates a lot of materials for us.
All right. Thank you very much for coming down to the station and talking about the work you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
My grandma's patchwork quilt, squares of corduroy and silk, red and green and blue and yellow too, on my grandma's patchwork quilt. Just a patchwork quilt so fine, it was an art of her design. A piece of sister's dress next to grandpa's vest, on my grandma's patchwork quilt. On my grandma's patchwork quilt, squares of corduroy and silk, red and green and blue and yellow too, on my grandma's patchwork quilt. Got a pillow for my head, and it wants to be my friend, but nothing keeps me warm in a thunderstorm like my grandma's patchwork quilt. Ah, oh, my grandma's patchwork quilt, squares of corduroy and silk, red and green and blue and yellow too, on my grandma's patchwork quilt. Now my grandma's gone to rest, and her quilt is all that's left, but her love, I swear, is in every square, on my grandma's patchwork quilt.
Ah, my grandma's patchwork quilt, squares of corduroy and silk, red and green and blue and yellow too, on my grandma's patchwork quilt.
Around the world the people wait for a day there's no hate, and we treat each one like my grandma done with her crazy patchwork quilt. Ah, my grandma's patchwork quilt, squares of corduroy and silk, red and green and blue and yellow too, on my grandma's patchwork quilt.
This is Bird Note. After dark, when most birds sleep, a few break into song, like this whippoorwill. The whippoorwill is a true night bird, feeding and mating and nesting in the dark. But a few songbirds that are active during the day also sing at night. Most renowned is the nightingale of Europe and Asia. In North America, for about a week each spring, the yellow-breasted chat also sings in the darkness. Why would a bird that carries on all its other activities during the day sing after sunset?
yellow-breasted chats migrate at night. A male singing, then, may attract a mate more readily, because it has the sound stage largely to itself. Most other birds are silent, and the cooler nighttime air carries sound more efficiently than during the day. Chats at night also sing shorter and lower-pitched songs, with longer gaps between songs, a song pattern that carries well over long distance. Once the females have all arrived for the season, the male chats go quiet at night, but not the whippoorwill. Did you know that you can hear Bird Note day or night? Catch it as a podcast at iTunes or on our website, birdnote.org.
Today's broadcast is supported by the Silver Bow Bakery, offering four different made-to-order salads each day for the summer season. The Silver Bow Bakery, located downtown on 2nd Street.
Time is 3:41, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Coming up next, a song by Meg Mackey, who's going to be performing this Friday night at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center at 8 o'clock. Opening act of Liz Snyder. She'll be performing in concert with her band this Friday night at 8 o'clock at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. Tickets are available from the Juneau Arts and Amenities Council.org. In the studio with us now is Rory Darling. He'll be joined possibly by John Gagin here to talk about Duplicate Bridge Club sessions, which meet Wednesdays. Rory, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
So describe the game and its basic rules, if you could, please.
The game is a very popular game worldwide, played with the whole deck. There's an auction where you bid, and then you play the cards, and you either make your contract or you don't. It's that simple.
It didn't sound very simple to me. Could you elaborate a little bit more?
It's simple in the sense that the rules are fairly simple to follow. What's complicated is the play of the cards themselves. You have to remember a lot of things to play it well. It's a competitive game, and so when you're playing against other people, they know the same things you do, so it's a one-up kind of game.
Is it difficult to learn?
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, it's got a long learning curve. While the rules are simple, in order to play it well, you need to go through a progression of steps, and the best thing to do is take a few lessons, which we offer here locally. My wife, Jan Moyer, teaches bridge classes occasionally, and so through the bridge club, the local bridge club, we offer classes for people that are interested in taking the first step and then progressing up into a more complicated situation.
About how many people are involved locally?
The Juneau Bridge Club is about 40 active members, and I'd say on any given night, We have maybe 20 people that participate. We play both Wednesday nights at 6:30 and Sunday afternoons at 1.
How difficult it is to get better?
It's not difficult to get better if you play frequently. It's the kind of thing where repetition is beneficial. And people play over a long period of time throughout their lives. And so one of the interesting things about the game of bridge is that it is a lifelong thing, and people play for years and years and years and find something interesting both at the beginning of their bridge careers and late in their careers as well. So that's one of the things that makes it an interesting game.
Tell me about your affiliation with the national level.
Bridge is a worldwide game, and I've traveled internationally and played bridge when I travel. In America, the game is governed by the American Contract Bridge League, which began in the mid-30s, I'm going to say. I don't know exactly. And I think there's approximately 400,000 members, and there are clubs around the country that are affiliated with the American Contract Bridge League, and the Juno Bridge Club is one of those clubs. And the significance of that is that the game is conducted the same way throughout the country. So any club you would go to in the country that was affiliated with the ACBL, you would get the same bridge experience. There are also national events that are very popular. Bridge is actually a very, there's a lot of money involved with bridge. People spend a lot of money to travel to big tournaments, and it's quite complicated that way, but there are national tournaments, regional tournaments, sectional tournaments. So in other words, there are different ranks of games that you can play in, and some of them are quite well-known, quite well-attended.
Why do they call it duplicate bridge?
They play a duplicate bridge because the measure of success is not how well you play any one hand. The same hands are played by different people in the course of an evening. So in other words, the hands are duplicated among all the players in the game, and so you're measured of your success is based on how well you play the same cards that other people have played as well. That's what's called duplicate bridge.
I see John Gagin is wandering into the station here. John Gagin, welcome to the airwaves here. We're talking about bridge, of course, and you are Rory Darling's partner. And my question to John and Rory, of course, would be, you talk about partners. What is the benefit of partner play?
I think there's two big benefits to bridge. First is the social aspect. You sit down at a table, play cards with people for a half hour, have a pleasant conversation, and then move on to another pair of people. The other big benefit of it is it exercises your brain, and I think that I generally think that's a good thing, especially throughout your life, to continue to develop those things. So the social aspect and the thought aspect.
And we have a friendly game here. Some of the big cities down south, if you wanted to find some of the most disagreeable people you could find, you'd head to the local duplicate club. But it's not that way here. We're all regulars. We all know each other. So it's like Rory said, we enjoy playing the game, but we also enjoy seeing each other every week.
What's the highest point place in bridge some people can aspire to, and they get that by a series of points?
Yes, there's the American Contract Bridge League has a master point system. So in other words, when you play in a tournament, whether it's at your local club or on a national event, there's a certain number of what they call master points associated with it. In some ways, it's an attendance award. In other words, if you play a lot, you'll get a lot of points. It's not necessarily a measure of how good a player you are. But there are rankings that people get that are based on accumulations of master points, and nobody in Juneau is anywhere on the big charts.
Nobody in Alaska is, for that matter. But,
that's correct. There's a very large industry surrounding bridge, and when you get to the serious level, you're at a whole different level of level of play, level of concentration, travel, competition's much better.
And believe it or not, there's people down south, wealthy people, will hire the best bridge players and play with them. You know, the player will play with one of them, and then all their teammates are these super pros, and they're doing this just for the glory of it. People, you know, people often say, well, is there money involved or something? I say, no, there's just master points and prestige, and a lot of people just, they don't understand that at all.
The money's in the side game.
Remember you said earlier, talking about the auction as far as the deck is concerned, does that involve money at all?
No, not for the sanctioned games. There's no, of course, it's a game, so you can play any game for money. But in terms of the sanctioned events that we conduct, there's no prize money or betting or anything like that. It's simply a contest, and at the end of the night, you either come up on the top or in the middle or the bottom, and we all go home and
gloat.
Some of us go home feeling good, and some of us go home and lick our wounds.
Or sulk, that's correct. You can also play bridge online. There are a number of online forums if you're that type of person. I like the social aspect of it, but it is possible to log on to the Internet and participate in a bridge game at your computer terminal.
There's also the bridge column on the Empire.
There is the bridge column in the Empire, which is a very interesting thing. I'm very appreciative that the Empire maintains that column. It's informative. It keeps it in front of people's eyes on a daily basis, and I think that's a good thing. I think it reinforces the fact that it is a universal game, and I think that's important for people to understand. In other words, when you enter the bridge world, you're entering into a very large society, which is a nice thing.
And actually, there's probably, 8 or 10 different bridge columns that are written by different people and syndicated in various newspapers. So it is, when I was back in college, everybody played bridge. It's not that way anymore. I think video games have cut into a lot, but it's still pretty popular.
Another thing that you can do online while we're talking about that aspect is that you can also learn online. The main website for the ACBL, the American Contract Bridge League, is acbl.org. And if you go there, they have resources, and some of those resources are learning resources.
But if you're interested in following the local masters here in the sport, the game?
Yes. When you become a member of the ACBL, they have a monthly newsletter, which is informative. They talk about two things. They talk about big tournaments. They'll have a summary of it, and then they'll also have instructive columns. And I read it every month. And,
yeah. And they've got them on three levels. They have some columns are for very beginning players, some columns are for intermediate players, and some columns are for pretty advanced players. So whatever level you're at, you can always pick something up from it.
Yeah, and there are big names in the game, and once you get into it, you recognize the names, and they have personalities, and they're quite entertaining in many respects. It's a fun thing.
And you meet on Wednesday nights at what time?
6:30 at Fireweed Place.
And it's usually over by about 10. We moved it up from 6:30 because we weren't finishing up till 10:45 or so, and that was too late, so this works much better.
Right, and we also have a regularly scheduled game on Sunday afternoon at 1 p.m. at the Downtown Senior Center as well.
Is there a phone number people could call if they need more information?
You can call me at 957-6971.
And when is the next time you're delivering lectures as far as teaching?
That won't happen. That's pretty much based on the informal interest that we get, and that will not happen until November at the earliest.
And Rory and Jan are both excellent teachers, and I have to say they are largely responsible for the fact that we still have a bridge game in Juneau, because we have had a lot of people move away, and Rory and Jan have taught a lot of people over the years, and not all of them come and play. Some of them just play at home, but a lot of them have come in and started playing, and we encourage that very much.
Yeah, thank you, John. We try and make it a friendly, fun thing. I'd like to emphasize that, even though it is competitive. And if you want to contact the Juneau Bridge Club, we also have an email address, which is junobridgeclub@yahoo.com. So if you're interested in being notified when classes happen, send us an email at junobridgeclub@yahoo.com, and we will keep you informed.
All right, Rory Darling and John Gagin, thank you for coming by and talking about bridge. Wednesdays at 6:30 at Fireway Place, and Sundays also at what time?
1 p.m.
The Juneau Senior Center.
That's correct.
Thank you for coming by.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
You're weary, feeling small when tears are in your eyes. I will dry them all. I'm on your side. Oh, when times get
It's 3:59 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sarsuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. We're also live online at www.ktuo.org. Weather forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers. Low temperatures around 48 degrees. Forecast for Wednesday, mostly cloudy skies with isolated showers and low temperatures or high temperatures around 50 with 61 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today.
We have a buffer zone now. I mean, it's not like declared by the Turkish government, but it is.
A Syrian refugee camp just across the border in Turkey is now home to more than 10,000 Syrians.
It's Tuesday, July 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Blanc. We'll hear from the refugee camp.